the sound of praise for your Sunday morning.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Introducing Reverend A.R. Bernard of the Christian Cultural Center.
Was the son of a preacher man.
And Rabbi Joseph Potasnik of Religion on the Line.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Now, on Talk Radio 77 WABC, here's the Reb and the Rabbi, where faith matters.
Good morning, I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard. You sound clear and strong this morning,
listen,
Rabbi.
It's 7 a.m. and married people are getting up and single people are getting home. So, you know, we have two audiences with us today.
Is that from your congregational experiences or what?
I'm going to tell you what side I was on, you know, with the, you know, the getting up and the getting home. I remember, I'm sure you recall, when we were younger, our parents would wait up for us. So you chose to, you know, to come home at a later hour. You knew what was waiting or who was waiting for you.
Wait,
I see Avon, our producer, smiling. I think she can relate. Even the younger generation understands, right? If you're living at home, you are bound by rules. And by the way, that is something that I think too many homes don't have. They don't have enough rules.
Yeah, I agree. And Ava's probably smiling because it was tougher on girls.
Yeah.
The guys got a little slack coming in a little later, but girls, they had to be home at a certain time and with very little leniency, which I have to say I agree with. I have sons, don't have daughters, but if I did, I'd be tough. I'd be tight.
I remember one story I have to confess, although I can confess to you because no one else, you know, can hear this.
No one else can hear us.
So
just you and I.
I remember coming home early in the morning, going to my room, and I was living with my parents, and my dad would go to services at the synagogue. And he came into my room. He said, "I see you're dressed." I said, "Well, Dad, I'm going with you to services, so I wanted to get up early and go with you." And he looked at me and said, "Yeah, I understand. I'm so proud of you and being so ready to come with me and being dressed at this early hour." But he knew very well, because one of the things you also learn is you can't fool your folks. You know, they're not as non-intelligent as we thought they were. They were pretty smart. And as we get older, realize they were very smart.
That's the reality. What you just stated there is it, Rabbi. As we get older, we realize how smart our parents were.
Yeah. And, you know, the word accountability, we've heard many times. The trouble is we don't see it enough, but we hear it enough. And you see what's going on, whether it comes to behavior on campuses, in classrooms. We see it now in high schools. What are the consequences for deviant behavior? You know, you may get a look of disapproval, but there's nothing more in some cases. And if you're not held accountable, a number of people suffer. The victims, but also you, because you think you can continue to behave this way and commit more hateful actions.
You know, there's a wonderful passage, and unfortunately, I don't recall exactly where in Proverbs. In fact, it's the 29th chapter of Proverbs. But it basically speaks about a situation where you can speak to someone, but it's to no avail because they won't listen unless there's some consequence to the actions that they engaged in that were wrong. And it is so true. If we don't experience the consequences of our choices, we'll never learn wisdom. We'll never adjust our choices or our behavior.
You know,
very real.
When our parents would chastise us, there's one thing they wouldn't tolerate: the rolling of the eyes. You remember that? If you dared to roll your eyes, you weren't going to roll them again, right? But you paid a price for it. And I just see what's happening all around us, and young people are thinking, it wasn't so shameful what I did, because if it were that bad, they would have, you know, reacted differently.
And in those days, we had the rod of correction. Now you can be taken to court. You can.
I got my rights.
Things have changed.
I got my rights. You can't touch me. I'll call children's services. Yeah.
Well, let me tell you a story. I'll, since we're confessing, we'll confess one to another.
Yeah.
Here, You know, I had a leather belt with a buckle that said Jesus Saves on it.
This is not going in a good direction.
my kids knew when they did something wrong, and I never forget the day they were all in trouble. Nobody would talk to confess who broke the vase that was in our living room. So I had them all line up, and I said, I want you to line up and face Jerusalem. And they got one whack a piece, right?
And did they all look the same direction?
Yes.
So they knew
the same direction.
At least they knew what Jerusalem was.
They knew what Jerusalem was. But Rabbi, that's the last time I saw the belt. I could not find it after that. Years later, I found out that my wife was part of the conspiracy. She hid it with them.
Well, yeah, I found my mom also was a protector. You know, wait till your dad comes home. But I was frightened of that. But I also knew that she would protect me.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you once used a phrase. I remember you once saying something. You told your kids behaved because they didn't want to meet Jesus so quickly.
Right? I threatened them to get to heaven a little earlier than they expected.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you know,
we were talking. I know we have a guest, but we still have a minute or so, right? Yeah. You brought up the word denialism. Remember, we were talking about that.
You know, I'm talking to people about what's happening on anti-Semitic attacks on campuses. I'm talking to people about some of the high schools here in New York, where you had some shameful incidents of teachers being assaulted, Jewish students being assaulted. And the response was, no, it was just a handful, just a few, you know, as if that makes it kosher. But there is this need to deny or diminish instead of saying, no, that's a serious problem. And it doesn't matter how few, how many, we can't tolerate it. And there have to be consequences. There has to be what we just spoke of, accountability.
Yeah. And it's tough because we live in a culture now that if you hold people accountable, you're accused of being too firm, too hard, not forgiving, not gracious. And then we're too gracious and the crime rate goes up. We're not being tough enough and not holding people accountable. It is amazing. You know, the contradictions and vacillations of people's position on these issues.
Yeah. We have a guest today who's going to talk about the role of religion. I think the word accountability will probably enter into the conversation because one of the things we learned in our respective traditions, you are responsible for your actions, and there is such a thing as punishment. Her name is Dr. Aza Karam, who is the president and CEO of Lead Integrity, and she has a wonderful resume. We'll have a chance to talk to her about all that she has done and all that she wants us to do.
Excellent. It's going to be a great conversation. So don't touch that dial. Stay tuned for more of The Rev and the Rabbi right here on 77 WABC.
Where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, our guest today, to me, is the convener par excellence when it comes to bringing people of different faiths together. She is the CEO of Lead Integrity, president and CEO, former Secretary General of Religions for Peace, and she's a good friend. I'm talking about Dr. Aza Karam. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us today.
Indeed. Welcome to the program. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Doctor, I'm sure you've been asked so many times as we have that religion brings people together, and yet so many wars have been predicated on religion.
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond to that?
Two facts. Fact number one, there is no such thing as so many wars are predicated on religion. In our current context, religion, like any other ideology, it gets used to make justifications. But in truth, religions are not at war with one another. Fact number two, we are created different and we therefore have different religions. It is important for us to work together. If we don't work together as people of faith, yes, we will tend to argue and fight quite a bit. And one of the worst things to do is to argue and fight using religion, because that is dearest, nearest to most people around the world. So it's not a good idea to use that as a rationale for fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor, we were at a meeting this past week sponsored by the Tenenbaum Foundation. Rabbi Potasnik was there and a host of other faith leaders. and contributors. And it was an amazing discussion that evening. Yeah. And we talked mm-hmm. about clergy stepping in when mm-hmm. diplomacy breaks down. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed your response to some of the questions and what you had to bring to the table. You mm-hmm. were Secretary General of Religions for Peace. And what? How do we answer that question where religion comes in and faith leaders come in when diplomacy mm-hmm. breaks down?
Well, we answer it in two ways, I think. The first is to note that the original diplomats, folks who were tasked with building peace within nations and building peace between different communities, the original diplomats were actually religious leaders and heads of different religious communities, because our world was religious long before it was the secular institutions that we know today. So, frankly, if those are the original diplomats, it makes sense that we also keep them as very important resources of wisdom and very critical interlocutors in today's world. We have limited ourselves significantly by only looking at secular entities and secular diplomacy. And we're not learning from the wisdom of the religious, the oldest forms of diplomats. The second thing to say is this: if we focus only on the secular diplomacy of today, which is manifest best perhaps by organizations like our State Department or Foreign Affairs ministries, or sometimes even cultural departments and ministries, educational ones. But if we focus only on that, we end up losing the wealth of experience that comes from what people believe and how people believe, which is so fundamental to the being of so many people. So it is important to integrate the religious realities and those who speak for them in the way that we relate to one another. But the problem is that often when we do that, we don't integrate all our religious or faith realities. We end up being very selective. We'll talk about the Vatican and the World Council of Churches, for instance. We'll talk about the Sunni and the Muslim folks. Sorry, Sunni and Shia Muslims. We'll talk about different kinds of Jewish, Orthodox and conservative and reform, but we will never, in fact, we will rarely ever bring together the various religious, including our Buddhist and Hindu and indigenous and so many other belief systems. We rarely ever take that route of being inclusive of all different faith traditions, especially, and this is absolutely key, especially those who have experience in negotiating their coexistence with one another. Because there are some very, very profoundly religious communities which are quite happy being on their own and exceptional and exclusively so. Those are not going to be terribly helpful in a diplomacy that urges us to be peacefully coexisting with one another, in our diversity, with our diversity. What we need, therefore, is those who are well-versed in negotiating coexistence with difference, with diversity, so that it is multi-religious and not religious at all. It is that niche of leadership of faith communities that we absolutely need the wisdom.
So, Dr. Karam, I have a follow-up question to that. As you are in the Netherlands, a citizen of the Netherlands still, correct? So you're an outsider in a sense to the U.S. How do you look at the United States idea of separation of church and state? Because it sounds like you believe it's an integrated system.
No. So here's a very critical nuance that I try to say here as well, which is it's not about integrating one religion into your state framework. Actually, not at all. It is actually deeply wise to have a separation between affairs of state and affairs of faith. It is wise to have that separation. But the separation doesn't mean that they do not know one another. It's not East is East and West is West and never the twain shall meet. It is a separation of powers, of authority, of capacities that also means there is integration on a whole bunch of things in very select ways. Diplomacy, education, nurturing populations, public health, these are all areas of intersections of spheres of influence of both the religious and the secular state. But a separation of authority and powers is deeply valuable. Now, here's the thing. We need to intersect, and they definitely do intersect. Here in the United States, 70% of hospitals are run by and through some sort of church structure. So it's a bit silly to assume that we can improve public health, but not look at where the religiously run public health services exist to the tune of 70%. So obviously there's an intersection and an overlap there that needs to be taken into account so that when we talk about improving our public health infrastructure, we're talking about the whole of the public health infrastructure, not part of it. So, things like that, we need intersection. Education, we need intersection. But what the issue here is not the intersection of one religious reality or institution with the other. It's not either going to be Jewish or it's going to be Christian, whatever the varied modalities of that are, or it's going to be Muslim or it's going to be Hindu. No. When, in fact, when that happens, when any one state decides to integrate one religion and its massive infrastructure, that will always be at the detriment of the others. And that is a disaster. That's a recipe for a disaster. That doesn't spell good stuff. That spells creating divisions within communities. A multi-religious engagement and intersection of services and outreach to communities and diplomacy, that multi-religious makes the difference between peace and war.
Dr. Karam, I remember being with you at a very, very meaningful conference in Tokyo. And in the room, there was a representative from Ukraine. There was a representative from Russia. And I think the point you were making was that it's imperative when there are conflicts in the world that religious leaders come together and speak to each other and try to, have more input into the conflict, demonstrating dialogue. Because you know what happens sometimes when there's a conflict? We find, I've seen it in the States, let's say Muslim-Jewish, all of a sudden the dialogue removes itself. You don't have the dialogue. It's only when there isn't a conflict that all of a sudden we're talking to each other. That's not the way it should be.
That is exactly right. I think if we establish already the mechanisms that make us relate to one another in times of peace, in times of ordinary times, these are the mechanisms that, and that was a point you made, Rabbi Potashnik, and you also made, Reverend, in that meeting, which is when we have these mechanisms, they kick into action even more because the folks know one another. There have been relationships already built with one another. I'm not just going to come and know you because now my community is fighting yours, but I've known you for a long time and we've worked together. We've served our communities together. Now we really need to work together to help resolve this issue. That's when it works, and it works well. In the Tokyo meeting, Rabbi Potashnik, you will recall there were four representatives from Russia and four representatives from Ukraine, in addition to Eritrea, Ethiopia, Central African Republic, actually quite a few conflict settings. So the nuance that I think makes a huge difference is that there were multi-religious representatives from different opposing sides. So, for instance, in both the Russian and Ukrainian, we had the Catholic, the Orthodox, the Jewish, and the Muslim, each from each of these two countries. And they were not there alone so that they would be the only ones under the spotlight and have to feel like they're wrong, but they were there with other faith leaders facing challenges with one another. And so the diversity element, the multi element, created a space of mercy where they could actually speak with one another and not feel that they were simply being pointed the blame at, but they were brought together to share their very common situations and circumstances and help one another think through and out of that box of conflict.
I remember it was a heated exchange at one point.
Absolutely. And you contributed brilliantly to that.
Not to the heat. I brought the light, not the heat.
Absolutely, you contributed to the light. I stand corrected. And yeah. You basically asked one question, not unlike the one that Jesus asked when people wanted to stone someone. Whichever one of you doesn't have a sin, could you please then start throwing the stone? And you basically said, what about forgiveness here? What about forgiveness in our respective traditions that demands on us, that demands us to be forgiving towards one another? What about that? And you literally cast that spell. And by the way, even just after you left, because you left us a day early, Rabbi Joe, when you left, after you left, by the time of day three, the same protagonists who were not speaking to one another, who were sitting at opposite tables, had come together to share a meal. And that is profoundly the work of the Spirit. When you bring different people together and you don't simply point fingers at one community or the other.
One of the things that we were doing at the table, sorry for cutting you off, Rabbi, but one of the things that we were doing at our meeting last week is talking about how to encourage interfaith dialogue. Interfaith is a reality of the future. I don't think restricted to the United States, but globally. But especially here in the United States, that has been culturally Christian, interfaith is the future. In fact, I would venture to say that it's not the future, it is the present. How do we encourage interfaith dialogue?
There's also a very important nuance about the United States, Reverend, that I think is valuable to mention. It is this country that has produced or has effectively enabled the realization of four very, very powerful, longstanding international interfaith organizations. The Parliament of World Religions, the United Religions Initiative, Religions for Peace. This nation, this continent of a nation, has actually, thanks to its incredible diversity, enabled and launched global interfaith platforms. Like many other platforms, because this is also the country that launched a legacy of a civil rights movement. Right. But like everything else, there's a bit of a stall at the moment. There's a bit of a stall in diplomacy. There's a bit of a stall in being decent and kind and polite to one another. There's a bit of a stall. The issue is, how is it that we can reinvigorate this space? And it has to be a dialogue that is based on what our joint Christian brethren call diapraxis. What is diapraxis? Diapraxis is actually not just talking with one another, not just speaking and engaging with one another verbally, but actually serving, actually doing work together. This joint service, which interfaith dialogue is required for, but is not limited to, is what will distinguish a socially cohesive society from one that speaks very loudly. Everyone speaks loudly, but they really rather speak at one another rather than work with and live with one another. When we serve our communities together, that is the magic wand. That is the tipping point that allows us and enables us to move from talking to action, from dialogue to diapraxis.
Yeah. I find that what happens very often is dialogue, not dialogue. People are talking, you know, at the same time, not listening to the other. People often see religious leaders as somewhat, should we say, apart from the ground, that their head is in the clouds. They don't see the realities on the ground. But what we always say is, being religious doesn't give you the right to ignore what is happening on the ground. You have aspirations, you have lofty goals, but you simply can't close your eyes to the pain that people are feeling. That has to be part of the dialogue.
Absolutely, Rabbi. And there's, if I may, a very important nuance to what you just said. There are religious leaders who are leading congregations representing religious institutions. There are faith leaders who don't necessarily formally represent specific faith institutions. They are part of a community. There are faith-based or religious not-for-profits dedicated to humanitarian service and social service of people. There are, the world of religion is massive. If we only limit it to the religious leaders representing a specific religious institution, we're actually only looking at the tip of the iceberg. Because if you look below to see how religions and different kinds of faith leaders, leaders through what? Leaders because they have served, they actually serve their communities. They serve in public health, they serve in education, they serve in sanitation, they serve in nutrition. The oldest social service entities that the world, anywhere in the world knows, are actually religious. Our original schools were in and provided by religious institutions. Our religious original hospitals, clinics, places of gathering were usually, and still to this day, remain those that are provided by religious institutions and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, not-for-profits. So the realms of religion are incredibly vast. To limit it only to those specific religious leaders whose job, frankly, is to be spokespersons, not so much necessarily to be actively involved in community service, that isn't fair. Then you're not really looking at the whole picture of religion. And religious leaders need to also see not only their remarkable capability of absorbing and dealing with people's pain and trying to sort and walk through, but also their ability to serve their communities in so many other ways.
Let me question this, because you talked about clear separation of powers, intersection of services. But when it comes to politics, just how involved should religious organizations, religious leaders be involved in the political system?
So this is the question of the hour, isn't it? This is a multi-billion now, because we don't do millions anymore. We do billions, apparently. This is a multi-billion dollar question, isn't it? Because on the one hand, it seems as if you're saying, no, you really do need an integration of those different spaces. But on the other hand, some of us, like myself, are very clear about that. Wait, just keep the domains of authority separate. Which doesn't mean that you cannot collaborate on different shared concerns. It simply means that when it comes to the ultimate authority of each institution, it is kept separate. So that, for instance, a president of one nation that is attacking another cannot take under his arm the head of that particular church to come and justify the violence that is being perpetrated against the other nation. That should never happen. That should never happen. Religion should never be used as a justification of violence against one another, especially not in war. But it always happens, right? So then what's the trick? The trick, if I can say that, I don't mean to be facetious, but I think what has to be taken into account is that the religious domains, as diverse as they are, and they are way beyond specific churches. Remember, we said these are the spaces of service to communities. These are the spaces of political activism as well. These spaces become the conscience, the public conscience. Think of that image of Rabbi Herschel with Martin Luther King, with a whole bunch of Malcolm X, walking with interlocked hands to march together in the name of those shared values to the whole of America and the world, quite frankly, the civil rights movement. Think of that image. They were definitely playing a political role there, because they are articulating and leading and sustaining a movement that is social and committed, but they are not political representatives. There are Congress and senators and presidents and whatever who are politically representative. But this is a community that is the people, that represents the people. You can speak for people, you can mobilize communities, but you don't have to then become the president or the co-president or the person who's always speaking to the president. Usually, by the way, those who are always advising presidents and prime ministers tend to be from one religion. I dare you to find one country in which the political advisors who are religious, in which the political advisors to the political leader actually come from a range of religions from that society or community. I dare you to find one example.
Dr. Karam, one of the challenges for people in the pulpit today, and Reverend Bernard and I talk about this quite often, is you get a position, say you're a young member of the clergy, and you may be told sometimes, you know, rabbi, reverend, imam, whatever, you talk about religion, but don't you dare talk about politics. And you have to walk a very fine line. You're walking on a tightrope sometimes because you take a position which may be diametrically opposed to a political leader that's favored by a number of members of that congregation.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very difficult, and especially when you're a young person just starting mm-hmm. out and you want to mm-hmm. hold on to your position, you know, and yet you want to hold on to your principles to you know, resolve that or to integrate that is very challenging.
Understood. And of course, fully agreed. There is a difference, however, and I think this is part of the tension. This is why politicians in general either stay away from religion or utterly and absolutely abuse, exploit, and manipulate religion. There's hardly ever mm-hmm. a road in between. The reason being that the voice of the religious leaders and the religious institutions is a remarkably powerful voice. It is the most longstanding voice of accountability of conscience. Once mm-hmm. you transcend that line between being holding accountable and being yourself politically manipulative and authoritative and accountable, once you there is a very thin line, but it is a line nevertheless. You have to speak out for what is right and just. You have to hold political leaders and financial leaders and other cultural leaders accountable. Mm-hmm. There needs to be that accountability. Mm-hmm. We're suffering globally as a result of the fact that there isn't a way of holding anyone accountable. Nations, mm-hmm. multiple nations, people, individuals, there isn't. We've lost that touch to the rule of law, international norms. So religious leaders are even more important today to hold the political spaces accountable. But you can't hold them accountable if you are one of them. Mm. Then it's a bit odd.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Isn't that our prophetic role and our prophetic voice that we and a prophetic responsibility that we have to the society?
Absolutely. I believe so firmly. But the prophetic voice, you see, is often now increasingly becoming part of a political establishment that is geared towards interest of some, not all. And when that happens, the prophetic voice loses the prophetic. It simply becomes another political voice.
You know,
an actor. Right.
Reverend, think back to the Golden Calf incident where Moses comes down, sees what is happening, smashes the tablets. But Aaron, who was with the people, kind of looked the other way. He didn't chastise them. He let them get away with it. And I think, Dr. Karam, what you're saying is that too often we let him get away with it. And if you look at the horrors of history, I remember Elie Wiesel used to say quite often, another great, I felt, prophetic figure, used to say, you know why the Holocaust happened? Because they felt, and many knew, they could get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there, when you're saying holding people accountable, is to say, we're not going to close our eyes. We're not going to close our mouths to what you're saying, what you're doing. There is an accountability that not just in the next world, but in this world.
That's exactly right, Rabbi. And I think I would have to say that two things. First of all, that holding accountable, as you've just articulated so eloquently, is more necessary now than ever. Because of what's going on in different parts of the world, especially within the context of Israel and Palestine. That silence, turning away, is not an option from whatever atrocities are being committed. And the other thing to say is this, in the Islamic tradition, in our holy book, the story of what happened to the Israelites and the fact that when Moses came back and found what they were doing, got so angry, the story goes that Moses gave his brother Aaron a very hard time. How could you let them do this? And Aaron's response is very interesting, and it's very telling right now. It really resonates within me deeply, powerfully, because Aaron, who was being given such a hard time by his brother Moses, said, "They would not listen to me. They would not listen to me." I think this is the cry of a lot of us, and especially many of us who are in spaces where we feel either that we must be silent or that we are silenced, but they would not listen to me, is a lot more than turning a blind eye. It is that incredibly intense hardship of trying to speak the truth, of trying to hold accountable, but being alone in doing so. Mm-hmm. And the issue here is that it's not right for us to leave those who speak to be alone. It is not right to be silent, but it is even more not right to not want to be together in solidarity to hold accountable.
Mm. Wow. Very well articulated. Very well articulated. Wow. I'm going to ponder that. I've got about four sermons out of that, Rabbi. You know that, right?
You know,
thank you.
Aza, I go back with you a few years, and I have to tell you, we'd go into a room, Rev, and here you had faith leaders of all these different traditions, and Aza was not afraid to speak her mind. I always admired this kind of conviction that refused to be silent, that spoke as she saw. Remember, you're dealing with people. You're the convener. You're bringing them together. At the same time, you're holding them accountable. That's a very difficult thing because you know you may pay a price because they may not stay together because of what you're saying. And Aza, you've never wavered.
You pay the price.
What's that?
I do pay the price. Absolutely. I pay the price.
Yeah, well, no better convener. Yeah. No better convener.
Thank you, Rev.
She is an extraordinary person.
And
being a woman in a male arena makes it even more
male dominated environment. Yeah. But you know, look, what can you say? I mean, she clearly articulates with passion, her understanding, and it's very compelling. I mean, I enjoy listening to her respond to these questions, Rabbi.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I just want to offer a story, which I think has a message for all of us. Tell a story of a flight, and the movie In Flight was the Ten Commandments. And people are watching it, and after a while, the pilot says, you know, we're going to be landing soon, and we're going to, you know, have to turn off the movie, even though it hasn't ended. And one of the passengers began to complain. And the flight attendant said, look, I'm sorry we're doing this, but you've read the book. You know the ending. And the passenger said, but you know the movies. The movie is never like the book. And I think as we look at life today, we have the book, but the movie is different. And I think our responsibility is to reconcile the two so it resembles the book a lot more than what we're seeing. And we can only do that, Aza, if we have people as courageous as you who are not afraid to say what needs to be said and heard.
And you invited me and provided me with this platform. So actually, you are key to this kind of a process. You are absolutely key. You have the voice. You have the platform. Keep involving the voices that echo yours, that are also not afraid, that wish to speak for truth and for others. It is in your hands to provide those platforms, Reverend and Rabbi. It is in your hands, especially in this country.
You know, Rev, when I leave this world, I want Dr. Karam to offer one of the tributes to me.
Oh, a long time from now.
And you also, Reverend.
I can agree with that. Yeah. You know, I will tell you, I love how comfortable she is in her own faith tradition and still able to engage in civil discourse with others in their faith traditions. We're at a time in a climate where it's like we are afraid that we'll lose our own faith if we sit down and have a conversation with someone of a different faith. It's unfortunate. So it's just to be celebrated when we can have civil discourse and not be afraid of losing our own faith identification. Thank you, Dr. Karam, for what you do.
Thank you very, very much.
President and CEO of Lead Integrity. And that's what we need today. We need people who lead with integrity.
With integrity.
Right.
That's it.
Thank you, Aza. Thank you, Dr. Karam.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yes. Bye. Thank you for being on the program. And thank you, our listeners. We'll be back after this break right here on 77 WABC.
The the sound of praise for your Sunday morning.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Introducing Reverend A.R. Bernard of the Christian Cultural Center.
Was the son of a preacher man.
And Rabbi Joseph Potesnik of Religion on the Line.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Now, on Talk Radio 77 WABC, here's the Reb and the Rabbi, where faith matters.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potesnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reb, I was very, very impressed with the depth of knowledge. You know, we always were told, surround yourself with smart people, you learn from them. And when you listen to Dr. Karam, you learn something. She certainly has the expertise and she has the experience. She has, you know, the learning and the, you know, she's been there, done that. So it was a pleasure.
Yeah, and you understand that within the Muslim faith, scholarship is everything. Your credibility is based upon scholarship, especially as an imam. And to have a woman speaking on behalf of the faith, because you know that's another issue in terms of the place of women within Islamic culture. So, you know, she's accomplished much. You look at her resume, and you could see she's steeped in religious understanding, not just her own, you know, but multi-faiths.
Yeah.
And to delve into scripture, the Old Testament, the way she did around the conversation concerning Moses and Aaron, I was impressed.
Yeah.
I was really impressed with that.
What also came across when you and I were at the that gathering of interfaith leaders sponsored by the Council on Foreign Relations and the Tannenbaum Center, is that we understood that particularly during a time of crisis, we need to have these difficult conversations with one another, but you don't wait till there is a crisis to have a relationship with one another. You know, sometimes crises inspire relationships, and I think we try as best we can to make sure that we're one step ahead, that we've developed the contacts, we've developed the familiarity with the other, so when the crisis arises, we can pick up a phone, we can call, and we can talk to each other in a very civil fashion.
Yeah. And you could tell in the room, there was you, there was Elder David Buckner, and the Cardinal, and myself. And our comments included the fact that we have ongoing relationship where we affirm each other, respect each other's differing views, and yet work together to address issues. And that is very necessary if we're going to have solid interfaith dialogue. We have to have relationship building before the crisis so that when the crisis comes, it's easy for us to collaborate. It's easy for us to convene because we know each other and we know our positions and we're ready to find common ground.
You know, I've often heard people say, and I'm sure you have, you know, be very careful, be cautious when you're in the interfaith area, because what may happen is you will dilute your identity to seek favor from others. And I have found, being in that interfaith area with you and so many others, it strengthens my religious identity. Because if we're going to talk about a topic, I have to know what my tradition says to me before I have the conversation with you.
Exactly.
Right?
Yep. Exactly right. It forces you to know more about your own faith just so that you can engage in dialogue, intelligent discourse. Very, very important. You know, I like the fact that we talked about how do we encourage interfaith dialogue. And one of the things that I brought up, as you know, is creating safe spaces for healthy discussion and healthy debate. And I think it was their CEO, I forget who he was, who responded by talking about how do we define safe spaces? What's the criteria for safe spaces? And interesting, we just say safe spaces, and all of a sudden we've got to bring in a set of boundaries and rules just for safe spaces.
Yeah, and you know, we have recognized, we as Jews and other people who have been victimized by hatred, we can't solve it alone. Jews can't fix anti-Semitism by themselves.
Right.
It needs a partnership. It needs a collaboration. And only when faith communities come together and say, your problem is our problem. And by the way, whether it's anti-Semitism, racism, whatever the issue is that impacts one group, then it requires the commitment from other groups that we're going to work with you to see if we can diminish, hopefully destroy, but at least diminish it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And look, blacks and Jews have a history in this nation in terms of our experience. We experienced segregation and marginalization differently, but the fact still remains that it was common ground. So that's why you can have a Heschel working with Dr. King, you know what I mean? You could have these kind of relationships towards the same ends. Yeah, that's very real. Because look, if we're a minority, right? Yeah, and we're going up against the dominant culture, we need help. We need support from within the dominant culture. That's a reality.
That is why it is so disheartening when you see in some places a separation between African-American community and Jewish community. You know, there was an article in the paper that appeared, and you and I have spoken about it. October the 7th, you know, was that defining moment where we saw who stands with us during this critical period and who does not. And we were shocked by the number of people who didn't say a word. Or if they spoke about it, they tried to contextualize, well, you have to understand, you know, rather than just a straightforward condemnation without equivocation. So,
yeah,
you know, we need to re-examine the relationship and see what happened and how we get it to be where it needs to be.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Great, great interview, great conversation. And I love how clear and how articulate she was in terms of position and her understanding. Really, really fascinating. Yep. Yes.
All right.
All right. So until next time. Right, right here on The Rev and the Rabbi on 77 WABC, we pray that you will be well, be safe, and be blessed.